This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Brandon Contes.
All righty, welcome to episode 44 of the Awful Announcing Podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Contes, and this week we are joined by co-host of Afternoon Drive on 670 The Score in Chicago, and now the co-author of a new book titled Pipeline to the Pros, Danny Parkins. Danny, thanks so much for coming on the podcast today, and I will do the obligatory hold the book up for the camera, Pipeline to the Pros by Ben Kaplan and Danny Parkins. So Danny, how did you get to this point of adding author to your resume? Why write a book?
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Brandon. Why write a book? Well, Ben Kaplan's been my best friend since third grade, and he was the point guard of our high school basketball team. I did the play-by-play. He went to Amherst. I went to Syracuse. Our wives are close. Our parents were close. Are close. He's basically family, and I don't think we've ever spoken on the phone. And he's like, I gotta call you and run something by you. I was like, oh, man, this must be serious. And he said, did you know that 12 of the 30 teams in the NBA right now, either their top basketball decision maker or their head coach, play D3 ball? I was like, I had no idea. That's insane. And he's like, I think there's a book here. Would you want to partner up on the project with me? And at the time, my wife was pregnant with our second child, had a young son. My dad's dementia was significantly worsening. My brother had just been diagnosed with terminal brain cancer, and I've got a full-time job. And I thought I was going to say no, and I didn't say yes immediately to joining the project. But then I was like, you know, I don't know that, first of all, it's his dream project, and it probably won't get made as a data analyst with no media profile if I don't sign on. When in the world would I have another opportunity to work on something like this with my best friend who isn't in the media industry? And you know what? I got so much going on in my personal life. Yeah, I feel like my cup is already runneth over, but maybe if I add something else that is positive and a nice distraction, it would actually be a good thing. And so I said yes, and I'm so glad that I did. My brother has since passed away. We're donating a portion of every book sold to brain cancer research. My dad passed away, and Ben's dad tragically got diagnosed with a rare form of cancer and passed away. So the book is dedicated to those we lost along the way of the writing process. It was a really emotional thing, but I got to work on something with my best friend. I'm immensely proud of the final project. We did over 100 interviews. I'm estimating it roughly 800 hours of research. It is an incredibly thorough, well-researched book that tells the story of NBA history and the modern NBA and profiles some of the biggest names in the sport, guys like Popovich and Presti and Brad Stevens and Leon Rose and Tom Thibodeau and on down the line. So it's I really recommend it to people, and I'm really proud of it.
Yeah, the amount of research that went into the book definitely comes across while reading it. How hard is it to write a book? Especially a book that does require so much research when you're researching what is essentially a new topic. Because a lot of sports radio and TV hosts they write books, but it's usually about either things that they've spent their career covering or it's about their own life experiences. But how challenging was this book and all that research that went into it?
Incredibly challenging. And, you know, Ben did the research, the vast majority of the research part of it. I did the vast majority of the interviews, and we collaborated on the rest of it. And it was, it's a challenging process, man, because everything about it, it's, you know, a radio show, you prep a radio show, you prep a take and you do it, and it's 4 hours a day and it's a lot. And then the show ends and you feel like maybe it was a good show, maybe it was a bad show, maybe it was a show somewhere in between. And the only thing that lasts from it is a podcast link. And maybe if something really cut through, you know, some form of aggregation on the internet. But this, you know, for years, literally, you see nothing for your work. Yeah. You know, no one's giving you feedback. There's no, it's just Ben listening to an interview that I did, or me reading an article that he found, and us texting about it, and us having lunch together and talking about it, and us talking about it. And you're just like pushing this boulder up a hill, like one half rotation at a time. And then finally you get that box of books in the mail and you take it out and you hold it in your hands, and Jeff Van Gundy's name on it is for the foreword, and Adrian Wojnarowski's name is at the top for a blurb, and you're holding this thing and you're like, oh my God, we actually did it. So it's just so different because it, like I said, I mean, it countless hours putting it together, and then you get it, and like the sense of accomplishment is unlike anything else I've really felt professionally.
Was there ever a point once you got started that you felt like it might just be too much work, especially for somebody that already does have a demanding job, or once you started, was the drive there to kind of complete it?
I mean, once you sell a book and you've got a contract to deliver a book on a deadline, you know, I never really considered quitting. There were some times where I was wondering if the juice was worth the squeeze. There were some times where it felt like I was trying to fit in 25 hours into a 24-hour day. But usually that was because of positive things, you know? Okay, I've got Hubie Brown for an interview. I'm going to allocate an hour. And we go 2 hours and 45 minutes. He ends up crying on the phone and then calling me back and leaving me a voicemail and apologizing for how long we went and saying we could talk more. And it was just like, oh my God, you're Hubie Brown, you're basketball royalty. I'm thrilled to be late to a couple of other things. You know what I mean? It was my honor.
Yeah.
So I mean, once you got into it and it's like, I'm spending 90 minutes with Brad Stevens talking about hiring and leadership. And I'm like, this is amazing stuff that big companies would pay big money for this type of opportunity. So I kind of just always had the picture in my head of how cool it would be, even if we only moved two copies, one to Ben's mom and one to my mom. And then I could frame the cover of the book and put it in my office. I was like, that was kind of my due north and my motivation whenever it felt a little overwhelming, because like I said, we had so much going on in our personal lives. And we, you know, we love each other so much. It was just that was the motivation. If any time in like the micro in the day to day, it was like, oh God, I got to interview, you know, fill in the blank person. It was like, okay, yeah, I got to interview Shaka Smart today for 45 minutes. That's not that bad. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So it was really rewarding, but nothing more rewarding than when you actually got the copy of the book.
Was everybody largely willing to participate in those interviews that you reached out to?
Yeah, with a couple of notable exceptions. Greg Popovich and Sam Presti would not sit with us. And it was Pop, you know, you understand why. Like, his secrecy is his thing.
Yeah.
He does not like to talk about himself. It's very hard. There are not a lot of podcast interviews out there. There are not a lot of profile pieces that he participated in, biographies, anything like that. We talked to a ton of people in his orbit. They gave us an indication that it was a maybe, a maybe, a maybe, a maybe, then it was a no. With the Thunder, we had literally over 100 communications back and forth. We thought that was going to be a yes. They made it seem like it was going to be a yes, but Presti is also very private, very secretive, literally on Pop's tree, you know, cut from the same
yep.
cloth. So part of the story almost became about the secrecy, the Spurs way, Spurs culture, those sort of things. Like, the people that you talk to that had worked there, they'll speak of it glowingly. They'll tell you some stories, but they'll also be sure that they're doing it with Pop's permission. And so, you know, those are huge figures in the book that unfortunately we were not able to talk to, you know, the firsthand source, but we made sure that we talked to a ton of secondary sources. And there's obviously enough that's been written about those guys who are among the most, Presti probably considered the best executive in the NBA. Pop considered the best coach in the NBA. It's not like there's a shortage of people who have covered them and written about them. It's just that they have not necessarily participated in the coverage. So unfortunately, those two did not sit for the book, but Phil Jackson, Daryl Morey, Jerry Colangelo, Frank Vogel, I mean, on and on down the line. So we talked to so many huge names in this for this book.
Jeff Van Gundy, who obviously wrote the foreword for the book, which I think was great. And it is just amazing to think, especially me being a Knicks fan, like about what he's meant to the NBA as a coach and as a broadcaster, and how easily he could have just ended up being a career assistant that nobody outside of diehard Knicks fans ever heard of before.
Yeah, you know, I've told this story on a couple of interviews, so I apologize if it's a repeat for anyone in your audience, but it is one of my favorite stories from the book. And there are so many good Jeff Van Gundy stories, by the way. Like I'll give you another one that's new here in a second if you're a fan of his. But he had been with a couple of different staffs, three different staffs with the Knicks as an assistant. And he kept surviving as there were staff turnover because he was good. But he was like, I'm never going to be able to be a head coach because of my background and because of what I look like and who I am. And then he gets the interim head coaching position for the Knicks. And the New York Daily News runs a column about who the next permanent head coach of the Knicks is going to be. And Larry Brown's the favorite, and John Calipari's the second favorite. And then they get a little disrespectful. Lou Carnesecca is listed at 5,000 to 1. He's 71 years old at the time. Red Holtzman is listed at 1,000,000 to 1. He was 76 years old at the time. And Jeff Van Gundy, who is the current head coach of the Knicks, they list him at 50 million to 1 in the New York Daily News. So the guy had the job, and people were still doubting him. It was an amazing, amazing thing.
Yeah, and I guess in defense of the Daily News, like Van Gundy, when he stepped in for Don Nelson that year, and it's not like the Knicks didn't start lighting it up that season. I think they actually lost in 5 to the Bulls that season in the second round. So like it certainly was.
It wasn't 50 million to 1 though.
No, it was not.
It was you weren't going to hire Red Holtzman.
Yeah.
Over. I mean,
yeah. No. Not in 1996.
Right. You're obviously doing it for comedic effect. I understand that. Yeah. But I mean, like, it's just ridiculous. Yeah. But Van Gundy is a coach's son. Unbelievably kind, unbelievably loyal, was super cool to sign on and, you know, talk to multiple times, let me call him to fact check stuff, agree to do the forward. He was great. But I mean, back in the day, he was also, you know, just as he was like coming up the ranks, you know, he called a timeout. He was mad at his players that they weren't like diving on the floor for loose balls.
Yeah.
And he calls a timeout and he's got his players in the huddle and he dives across the floor as the coach during a game to demonstrate what it looks like. And they're just looking at him like, this guy insane? What the hell is wrong with you? So he's always been that guy.
Yeah. And a little bit insane. I mean, willing to fight Alonzo Mourning on the court. Yes. Definitely yes. A little crazy.
Yeah. A little crazy. But I mean, a guy who would have been happy coaching at the D3 level for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
And it just kept working for him. Yeah. And, then he ended up being, you know, between him and Stan Van Gundy, over 1,000 wins in the NBA for a couple of D3 nobodies.
What about Duncan Robinson? Probably the best NBA player to work his way up from the D3 level. What was his interest level when you reached out to him and he heard about the book?
It was really cool because obviously, like, he's not really featured in the book at all, but he is referenced. Because, Williams is the only college that has a player, coach, and GM who are in the NBA. And obviously Duncan Robbins played at Williams, then transfers to Michigan, and then goes to the NBA. So the guys will be like, hey, he's the most successful alum. He signed the $80 million contract. You got work to do, Will Hardy, you know, head coach of the Utah Jazz. And so, you know, he's referenced as a D3 legend. But it was so cool because when I talked to him and he agreed to sit for the interview, he was like, I'm so happy someone's writing about this because he went to Williams knowing about the network that had been created among Williams alums, thinking that he could get to the NBA as a video coordinator. Like, I'm like, that's amazing to me. Like, you just signed an $80 million deal. You play, you're a sharpshooter, you're on the Heat. But right. He chose Williams because he was aware of the network and the pipeline that existed that he could get in front of guys like Sam Presti or Rafael Stone or Kobe Altman, not all of whom went to Williams, but who know, who are D3 guys scout, who run NBA teams, and that they hire other D3 guys, and that they send Sam Presti sends emails to select coaches of D3 programs asking if they have anyone on the team or as a manager who is smart, passionate, and would be willing to do the grunt work to work their way up through an NBA organization. Like, he mines that talent pool actively for it. And so I just thought it was so cool that Duncan Robinson was like, I've been waiting for this story to be told for forever. I knew about it when I was making my college decision. So I just thought that was an amazing validation of the project itself.
Will this book or should this book kind of change the way that D3 schools are valued at all?
That's an interesting question. I don't know. I think that the D3 community is really getting behind the book, and they're really pumped that the story was told and told as well as we did it. And I think that the dirty little secret is that the NBA is already valuing them because they're hiring them, you know? And because coaching staffs have expanded so much, because the G League is affiliated with an NBA feeder program, we got so many advanced scouts and video people and all of those sort of things, there are just more jobs available to be like, yeah, sure, I'll take a chance on a guy who, you know, plays at Middlebury or Oberlin or Amherst or wherever. It's like, yeah, sure, whatever. And now there's enough examples of the guys who had the success at the highest level that there's not nearly as much stigma of a star player to be like, you can't dunk. I didn't see your games on the NCAA tournament. That I think that these guys, part of what this is like they broke down the door. They broke down the barrier. They proved that they could do it. They got enough power that they could then hire their friends. And their friends, by and large, have proved that they could do it. And now it's going to be easier and easier for the next generation of D3 guys. So I think what the answer to your question is that like the NBA already respects the D3 background on the resume and in some cases even prefers it because of what it says about humility, work ethic, experience, intelligence, that sort of thing. But hopefully, externally for the masses, people will be like, I had no idea. And maybe take a few fewer shots at the D3 background.
Is as somebody like yourself who talks sports for a living but did not play sports, did this story interest you at all because of the stigma that some sports media personalities will have without having the background of playing sports? Because like there is always that low-hanging fruit for some past and current athletes who have an issue with a media member who can lean on, well, you never played before.
I could certainly relate to it. Yeah, I could certainly relate to it. Now, obviously, there's a lot of people in media who never played sports at a high level, but now athletes, correctly and deservedly, are cutting out us as the middlemen more and more and launching their own media products, and they're very, very good. And so I think that that's great that they're taking empowerment of their own story. But yeah, there's definitely something that I could relate to of I got to be sure that I got my bleep in order to be able to speak as an authority figure on the NFL when I'm 6'1", 150 with scoliosis. You know what I mean? And you're like a white Jewish guy from the burbs who, you know what I mean? So like, it's like, okay, yeah, I got to be sure I know my stuff. And these guys have to be sure LeBron's asking us for what this set means. I got to have the answer, because if he looks over at me and I don't have the answer, he's going to be real disappointed. And then he's never going to ask me again, because he's not asking me to show him how to block a shot at the rim. He's coming to me for my brain, and I can speak basketball well enough because I played it, but it's because of my brain and my basketball knowledge and my study habits and my work ethic. And so I think that there's definitely something that I personally related to in that story. No question.
You mentioned this at the start, but a portion of the proceeds of the book is going to the nonprofit organization Brain Up. So I'll ask you to expand on that a little bit.
Yeah, thank you. Brain Up is a Chicago-based brain cancer charity, quickly becoming the largest in Chicago. I joined the board of directors a couple of months ago. My brother Brad got diagnosed. Ben was in my wedding. I was the best man at his wedding, but he was not the best man at mine because I had a brother, and he just did not have a brother. So he was a groomsman, and Brad was the best man. And yesterday, actually, as we're taping this on April 10th, was 1 year to the day since Brad passed away. But Brad really was, he worked in, his life's work was in education. He really believed in science. And so he was drawn to Brain Up because all the money goes towards research and trying to find a cure. And brain cancer is a real tough cancer, and it's underfunded because it doesn't affect as many people as, you know, breast cancer and lung cancer and, you know, things like that. And so to hopefully make breakthroughs with it, it's going to have to come from private philanthropic efforts. And so this book is not going to solve brain cancer, but Brain Up also keeps the research right here in Chicagoland. My brother was treated at the Malnati Brain Tumor Institute at Northwestern, one of the best brain cancer hospitals in the world. And they fund research grants for them, is basically what we do with Brain Up, is we work with the 7 area hospitals here in Chicago and make them submit research grants. And then we've got a medical board at Brain Up, because obviously we're not tumor experts. And our medical board reviews the proposals that these hospitals want to fund for which ones have the most viability to help, hopefully make some progress in the treatment. And then we try to raise money to fund them. So that's what Brain Up's all about.
How do you handle things that you're going through personally when you're on the radio? Stuff like a parent with dementia or a brother with brain cancer. Like, are you somebody that shares a lot of that with your audience, or do you keep most of that private?
I share it with the audience. The stuff with my dad with dementia, I shared less of the specifics. I shared that my dad had Alzheimer's. It's such an ugly disease, and he was not really able to like sign off on that. And, you know, my mom and sister live in the area.
Sure.
And some of the things that happen with that disease are just so ugly that I wasn't really, it didn't feel fair to my dad to share it, because he wasn't him for the last few years. So I just would talk about that my dad had dementia. With brain cancer and my brother, Brad had been on the show. Brad came on the show to talk about his diagnosis. So I talked about it much more openly. We've raised money for brain cancer in his honor on the show a couple of times. So that I talked about more. There were just hard days. Like, I'd go and be with him in the morning and then, you know, drive in, and it's like I'm leaving him and he's in whatever state of decline he was in. And then it's like I'm processing that, and it's like, okay, now I've got to come up with a take on the Bears offensive line or the, you know, the Cubs lineup or whatever it is. And so it was sometimes like just for my own like reset, like the audience is coming to us to escape, but sometimes for my own reset, I would need to have like a little bit of a moment of transparency of like, hey guys, this is what I'm going through.
Yeah.
We're going to get to this stuff, but just FYI, A, B, and C thing, you know, and then get into it. So it was never like a daily or even weekly or monthly thing, but I talked about my brother quite a bit.
When would you say you became comfortable kind of being yourself and being willing to talk about things that are difficult on air? What was it? Was it at Syracuse? Was it at Kansas City? Is it something that you're still kind of working on?
My first favorite host I would listen to Howard Stern in the morning, and then in afternoon drive at the time in Chicago, it was Bors and Bernstein and Mac Yurko and Harry. And Bors and Bernstein was not as personal. They were just excellent and hilarious. And Mac Yurko and Harry was a soap opera, but it was led by Dan McNeil. And he talked about his struggle with addiction, and he talked about his son with autism. And obviously, Howard Stern lived his life on the radio. So, and then I ended up interning for Mac, and then I ended up co-hosting with him, ironically, for a little over a year in Chicago, which I never would have imagined was possible. But so, like, I've said that Mac was my first favorite radio host, and he lived his life on the radio. And so that's definitely a big influence. You get more comfortable with it as you get more life experiences and get older. So I definitely did it, you know, maybe would talk a little bit about a date when I was on the air in Syracuse, and then talk about, you know, my girlfriend who then became my fiance, like a relationship stuff in Kansas City, falling in love, that sort of thing. But also, you know, I was in my 20s, like,
yeah,
nothing had really, like, my life was partying and dating and working. You know, it was not terribly, and then I've had way more happen to me than a 37-year-old probably should in the last, you know, 4 years. So, I think I, with these things, it's where I started getting into more of the heavy stuff personally. I was always willing to give an opinion on, like, a big picture, real world topic. But the personal stuff, I think I needed to have the life experiences and be a little bit more secure in my radio voice to talk about those things.
When did you graduate from Syracuse? And then when did you land your first full-time on-air gig?
I graduated from Syracuse in 2009, May of 2009. And then I was unemployed. I mean, the housing market had crashed. The economy had crashed. There was a hiring freeze. Advertisers weren't spending. It was a tough time to graduate. I got a job back in Syracuse about 11 months after graduation. So April of the following year, had to go back to Syracuse kind of with my tail between my legs, thinking that I was going to get a bigger job. And then I was back in the college market. And it's weird. Like, it was a full-time job, but it was not a full-time job how people would define a full-time job. And what I mean is I was hosting the Danny Parkin show 5 days a week, and I was producing the show before me. But I was getting paid $9 an hour.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I lived with two random dudes from Craigslist. and so, you know, it was not glamorous. But, you know, the industry didn't know that. And the show streamed on the internet. And so I always tell kids who are trying to get into this thing that, like, your first job's your toughest job. Because getting hired off of, like, your own podcast or your college radio station or whatever the case may be, you got to do those things to get the reps. But it's very hard to get a job off of those things. But, like, once I had a job in Syracuse and I'm interviewing Jim Boeheim and it's streamed on the internet,
right?
Like, you know what I mean? Then I have something legit to send to the guy in Kansas City who ends up hiring me for my first job that had health insurance. So for my big break of getting health insurance and $30,000 a year to host 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. So, yeah, so that was kind of my start.
Did Nick Wright help to foster that Kansas City job at all?
I mean, Nick Wright is, Ben's my best friend from childhood. Nick's my best friend from college. You know, he's definitely helped me out. I'd like to think that I've helped him out in some ways. I know that I have, but certainly not in terms of getting jobs. Yeah, he was instrumental. He was doing afternoons. He's from Kansas City. And he told me that the midday show, the 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. show, was opening, like, before it was public knowledge that it was opening. And he said, call my boss and tell him that you're the guy for the job. And so he gave me his number. I called him. I left a voicemail. And it was something to the effect of, hi, my name is Danny Parkins. I heard through the grapevine that you're going to have an opening for a midday show. I currently host a midday show in Syracuse. My mom's side of the family's from Kansas City. So I grew up going to games at Arrowhead and Kauffman Stadium. You don't even need to post the job. I'm the guy for you. You can listen to my show here. I'd love to hear from you. And, like, 4 or 5 weeks later, I was going to a party at, like, in a hotel, and I'd had a few drinks, and I got a call from the guy saying, can you sit for an interview in 2 days? I was like, yes, I can. And ended up getting hired.
And then I think the Jovan Belcher, the the murder-suicide happened in 2012. So that was shortly after you started in Kansas City. I mean that is a big topic to cover early on in your radio career. And I think if I remember correctly, that did you do a ESPN hit when that happened, or a Sports Center hit?
I did. Yeah, I haven't thought about that in a while. That was a weird, weird day. Yeah, I was the first person to put that on the internet that it was Jovan Belcher. I remember Peter King retweeted me, and you know, it was like the first viral thing that happened. And yeah, Sports Center called. Like that was it was really weird to like have your profile increase a little bit over such a tragedy.
Right.
It's really, really weird. And it was a complete luck that I was there, like dumb luck. I had gotten the iPhone the day before and didn't have my like alerts silenced. And so I got a call because I was the guy who at the radio station lived closest to Arrowhead, that they had gotten a tip at our news station that there was like police activity at Arrowhead. And so like I woke up when I otherwise would not have woken up that early on a Saturday. And I was like, yeah, I'll go check it out. And so I drove to Arrowhead, and yeah, a cop told me what had happened. And then I was like, not sure that he was really supposed to tell me what happened. And then I was there when the spokesperson confirmed what happened. And I just went to Twitter and said what the police spokesperson had said. And yeah, so that's how that all went down. That was a crazy, crazy day. And then that awful Chiefs team won the game the next day. They were a 2-14 team, but they won the game the next day.
Yeah, I remember just watching I'm pretty sure it was a Saturday morning, and I remember watching ESPN, and I saw you on ESPN that day. So that's why that kind of popped into my head. Was that how difficult was that to cover? Is that something that you were ready to cover? Especially at that point in your career, is anybody ready to cover a story like that?
Well, yeah, I mean, people have to, right? People do that sort of thing for a living. What I like to say about me in journalism is that I know how to do it. I am not a journalist, though I have performed acts of journalism and I have a degree in journalism and I went to journalism school, right? I am a entertainer and a talk show host, but I have broken stories and I wrote a book and I did some coverage recently, broke a story about the Northwestern baseball coach and the toxic atmosphere within that program that led to the head coach being fired and was just nominated for a local journalism award here in Chicago. So like, I'm a golfer. I look at journalism like it's like my 60 degree wedge. I have it in my bag. I know how to hit it. I just don't hit it that often. So that was really tough, and I was really young, and it was a really serious story, but the journalism part of my education just kind of kicked in, and it was like, okay, speak to the facts. What happened? What were you told? When were you told it? Etc. Answer the questions in facts. Don't opine unless people ask you to. And so that was what I did. So was I ready for it? I don't know. Probably not. I was, I don't know, 25, maybe 20. It was in 2012, right?
Yeah, December 2012.
Yeah, so I was 26. I don't know. Like, you know what I mean? Again, like it's not like it was a 3-minute hit on SportsCenter that I barely remember, and I just told people exactly what I had been told by police spokespeople, you know? Right. So it was weird for sure to then have to do 2 hours on Monday and contextualize it next to an NFL game and then 4 hours and that sort of thing, but yeah, that was a weird one. I can't believe you remember that SportsCenter hit. That's funny.
Are the lines between journalists and sports radio hosts, is that blurred at all, or is it no? Sports radio hosts are entertainers. Journalists are journalists.
No, of course it's blurred. But I mean, like we are media. We get press passes. People tell us stuff. But I think we just need to tell people what hat we're putting on for this thing. You know what I mean? I think Caleb Williams is going to be a Bear. They haven't drafted him yet. And so I can say, I know he's going to be a Bear on the radio, and people will know that I'm not really reporting it. But yeah, if I tweet, report in all capital letters, the Bears have informed Caleb Williams that he will be the number one pick in the draft, I think I have enough credibility that that would get retweeted and big NFL reporters would have to track it down. You know what I mean? But I just think that like Woj, he does it on every tweet still. Sources, blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? Like to show people that it's a report. And I just think for talk show hosts, we got to like, people do not come to us with an expectation that it's reporting. So if we are reporting something, we've got to make it very explicit that we are reporting this. This is source-based. This is not opinion-based, because our default setting is opinion-based, which it should be.
Yeah. So does aggregators make that job more difficult at all because you're at risk of it getting pulled, an opinion getting pulled and kind of treated as a report?
Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of aggregators. I'm not a huge fan of them. I'm blocked by a couple locally because I talk a bunch of junk on them. I think it's congratulations for having no skill or talent. I think Elon Musk's new form of Twitter has made it worse and blurred the lines for people. And the blue check thing was so stupid to do. Like, I didn't care that I had a blue check. I cared now that anybody else can get a blue check. And the vast majority of the country and the world, if we've learned anything from the last 6+ years, or I guess 8+ years, it's that our media literacy is not very high. I used to think that I was like, man, you know what? I went to Syracuse and what my parents paid for was the network. You know what I mean? Meeting Nick Wright, meeting Andrew Filippone, meeting Mike Meltzer, meeting all these guys, doing radio together, listening to each other's tapes, helping each other throughout our careers. And I think that that is still by far the biggest part of it. But it blows my mind that people think that Breitbart and the Washington Post are the same, or that a meme is the same as the New York Times. You know, like I was off on that one. And so that aggregators, I think, fuel that intentional misleading disinformation just for engagement and clicks and retweets and that dopamine rush. Because as far as I can tell, most of these aggregator accounts on Twitter don't even monetize it. They just get off on having a lot of followers and getting a lot of retweets. Congratulations. You are a small contributor to the erosion of society and the public's ability to discern fact from fiction. I hope it's worth it.
You're not somebody who necessarily always sticks to sports. You make your political opinions, or at least some political opinions, known. It's not like you're just constantly talking politics or anything like that, whether on your show or on social media. But is your audience receptive to that, or is that something you get criticized for?
Yeah, both. You get criticized for everything. You get reception positively for everything. I don't do it that much anymore. I pick and choose my spots. I've learned that you're either preaching to the choir, which doesn't really accomplish anything, or you're pissing people off and making them turn away, which is also self-defeating. So I pick and choose my spots. When there was a shooting at Highland Park at the 4th of July parade a couple of years ago, and I was, you know, a town over at the 4th of July parade that started at the exact same time, and I was going to talk about it. And I was not going to shy away from my opinion on the ease at which people can buy semi-automatic rifles. When I hosted a radiothon to raise money for the Austin neighborhood on the west side of Chicago to fund the construction of a grocery store, I named it What About Chicago, the What About Chicago Radiothon, because it pissed me off that people nationally would try to make Chicago, you know, this bad faith argument about, well, there's tough gun laws in Chicago and they still have gun violence. It's like, yeah, but you know that we're an 8-minute drive from Indiana, and that they've got some of the laxest gun laws in the country, and that over 40% of recovered guns that are used in crimes come from out of state. So, you know, like, so I am not shy. I'm like sharing my opinion on those things, but I am picking and choosing my spots for when they're more like locally relevant to my audience. And that's just something that I've just kind of evolved with. And I just, I it doesn't do much good for me on my mental health to really engage in all of that stuff on social media. Social media is, the point of positive return on it is quickly dwindling. We'll see how much I do after I'm done with the promotion of this book leading into a presidential election. I think I'm going to be trying anyway to scale back. We'll see. Because I'm addicted to it like anybody else.
Yeah, yeah. How is it being somebody from Chicago, somebody that works in Chicago, and then you hear something like Jason McIntyre when he compares it to Afghanistan and just those narratives that people do push so often?
I was very upset about that. I think that he's a fool. I think he's uninformed and reckless, and I was very happy that Colin Cowherd checked him in real time. Colin loves Chicago. Colin owns property in Chicago. Colin knows that what Jason said was completely irresponsible and ridiculous and uninformed. And I disagreed with it on Twitter at the time. And if I saw Jason, I would say the same thing to him. I thought it was perpetuating a bad stereotype.
On the contrary, how was it when Colin Cowherd last week called you the most talented sports talk radio host out there?
That was awesome. that was much cooler. Kyle, that was an incredible compliment to get from one of the most talented people, if not the most talented person, to ever do this. That meant a lot to me. Colin tried to hire me a couple of years ago. We got to the 2-yard line on making it happen, where I would be able to do my show and a podcast for the volume. That ended up not being able to happen, unfortunately. I lost a lot of sleep over that. Maybe our paths will cross professionally again one day, but that compliment from Colin Cowherd meant a lot to me.
Did it, I don't know how much you've talked about it or what you can talk about, but did it not happen because of your radio contract? Was it, did the station or the company prohibit you from doing that?
Yeah, they knew that they were pursuing me. They talked to him about it.
Whatever,
it's fine. I mean, I assume this, whatever. Basically, Colin owns the volume 100%, and my company was cool with me doing the podcast for him under those conditions. But then at the very end, it came out that the person that was heading up sales for the volume was affiliated with iHeart, and iHeart's the biggest competitor of Odyssey. And so my company decided that was not something that they could live with. I disagreed because I thought that it should be, I thought that there should be value in your afternoon drive host in Chicago being promoted by Colin Cowherd as the best young talk show host in the country, and being platformed with him. And so that cost me a lot of money and definitely upset me. We move on.
So as you see ESPN kind of prioritize digital and a YouTube audience, especially with Pat McAfee, and you see the likes of Stephen A. Smith and Shannon Sharp prioritize their solo ventures and podcasts in addition to traditional media. Is it more frustrating? Does it almost feel obstructive to your career at all when then you have a radio company that doesn't or didn't let you do the same type of thing?
Yeah, man. Yeah. No, I'm not Pat McAfee.
Yeah, but the most talented radio host in the country is a pretty good tag.
It's a pretty good tag. Yeah. But I don't have McAfee's audience or power or contract.
Yes.
You know what I mean? The truth is I love the place that I work.
Right.
The Score is an amazing radio station and it's my dream job. It's all I've ever wanted to do since I was in high school. So I've worked for this company. I worked at Entercom in Kansas City. I got the job at the Score. And then a few months into my contract at the Score, which was CBS at the time, Entercom bought CBS and I was back working for Entercom. I've worked at Entercom/Odyssey since I was making $30,000 a year. You know what I mean? Like, and my career has gone very well, and my W-2s have increased significantly through that time. So I'd like to think that it's been a mutually beneficial thing. But it's like, I don't want to get it twisted. Like, I like the company that I work for. I love the radio station. I love the people in Chicago. But yeah, I do think that the industry is evolving rapidly, and some of the companies, because of just how big they are and what they are trying to keep up with the times, right? Like, I do a podcast with Andrew Filippone for Odyssey that we both love doing and is pretty successful, called First and Pod. But it's hard. It's hard for a huge company to be as nimble in the current market as a smaller company, like a digital company, like The Volume, or an independent operator like Pat McAfee. So would I like to do both? I would. And we'll see. Then maybe I'll be able to shortly. We'll see what happens. But don't get it twisted. I love doing an afternoon drive on The Score in Chicago.
Yeah, and I get that, because radio is my favorite medium. I still listen to WFAN every single day, and I will continue to do so for as long as it's offered to me. But I do also get that radio can be slow to adapt, and it would seem like a radio company allowing its talent to promote themselves should also be seen as a benefit to the radio company and the radio station.
Yeah. And listen, I get it. Everyone's got competitors and bosses and lawyers, and, you know, I can promote myself on TV and with the book and social media and all that. That was just one that, that got away. I'm not speaking out of school. My bosses all know this.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was a tough one because it's Colin Cowherd. That was a tough one.
Landing your dream job at such a young age, can you envision holding it for another 20, 25 years, or do you start to chase something else at some point?
I don't know. You know what I mean? When it was my dream job the first time, when Mac got bonused, he was able to fly his whole show to Hawaii for the week off his bonus check. You know what I mean? It was a different economy of radio. So I do very well. I am a careerist, and I do want to continue to grow and adapt and challenge myself and all of that. So I think 20 years, making a 20-year prediction in media is real tough. My deal's up in January. I like working at The Score. It's what I've always wanted to do. I always want to have a big footprint in Chicago and in my hometown. But making a prediction of like what that's going to look like, or saying like, I am absolutely going to work here for the rest of my career. Like, they might fire me. You know what I mean? Like, I might, like, who knows, man? This is a fickle, subjective, weird, unpredictable business. So I am not in that position to say that I will be here in 20 years, because I honestly don't know that I'll be here in February. I think I will, but I don't know.
How was working with Mac, Dan McNeil, after growing up listening to him?
Totally surreal. It was amazing. Something that you never think. I mean, because that was his third stint at The Score.
Yeah.
You know, he started at The Score, then he goes to ESPN, then he comes back and he works with Matt Spiegel, then he leaves again. There's been controversy in his career. He's insanely talented. It was surreal. So it was, never would have dreamt that it was possible. Hard at times, because he would openly admit that he was on, you know, the 16th hole of his career and wasn't interested in interviewing athletes anymore. And then COVID happened, so we're doing 5-hour-a-day shows before. He wasn't comfortable with FaceTime before Zoom, with no games. I'm doing it from my bedroom. He's doing it from his basement. You know what I mean? So it was not, but we did some really cool things together, and I'm really happy that I got to work with him, and I love the man. So it was an amazing experience. It was just one that, like, I never would have thought was possible. And then how it ended up happening was also not how I would have drawn it up either. So it was weird, but it was still satisfying.
And then, obviously, you had worked with Matt Spiegel in middays before he rejoined you in afternoons. Did you have a say in who was going to be your co-host after Dan had gotten fired, or was that something you did? Was that the first time in your career?
What'd you say?
Was that the first time in your career that you had a say in who you were going to get to work with?
Yes, it was. Kansas City arranged Solo, then arranged with Carrington Harrison.
Yep.
Then Chicago arranged with Spiegel. Then Afternoons arranged with Mac. And then I finally had enough pull and cachet and respect that I got to have a pretty significant vote on that one. I did not get to make Mitch Rosen made the final call.
Sure.
He had a bigger vote than me, but we worked on that very closely together.
Yeah, that's certainly nice to be at a point in your career where you get to have some sort of influence over a decision like that.
Yeah, and I mean, and with the producers too. I mean, Chris Tannehill is the best sound producer anywhere in radio. So he's been locked into, I think, four different afternoon shows. And like, if you're starting a radio show and you're not picking him as your sound guy, you're just wrong. So that was a no-brainer, but he's the best. And then had a say in Shane Reardon also, who is an excellent executive producer. So like this team on the Parkinson Spiegel show is, I've had a say in it, and I'm thrilled to work with all three of them.
I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about Caleb Williams. Is Chicago right now excited, optimistic, cautiously optimistic? What's the feeling about Caleb and the Bears?
It's amazing, man. It's amazing. There's definitely some spurned lover cynicism here. Like, prove it to me. I believed in Mitch. I believed in Jay Cutler. I believed in Justin Fields. I believed in Cade McNown. I believed in Rex Grossman. Like, never seen a 4,000-yard passer. Never seen a 30-touchdown quarterback. The only fan base in the NFL that could say those things. So there's definitely some people that are taking a wait-and-see approach. But they've also never been in this spot. I mean, it's a number one pick, quarterback, top prospect, coming into a team that won 7 games last year. It's not your pick that was number one. It's someone else's. You've got what should be a top 10, maybe top 5 defense. You've got one of the 5 best wide receiver duos in the NFL. You've got a great rookie contract right tackle. You've got a serviceable rookie contract left tackle. You've got a good left guard. You've got a good right guard. You've got a good tight end, and you've got a good running back, and you have the 9th pick in the draft. Like, if Caleb Williams is as good as everyone says he's going to be, the Bears are going to win a lot of games immediately. So it's very, very exciting.
Was there a real divide over whether to trade the pick and stick with Justin Fields? Yeah, that was legitimate.
Oh, yeah. Locally. Yeah, because I mean, Justin is likable, and Justin made chicken salad out of chicken you know what, and unbelievable leader, and he's good. And so the idea of like, wait, we haven't had good. Now we're going to give up good to maybe have a guy who busts, and people had just seen what you could get for trading away the rights to Bryce Young. So imagine what you could get trading away the rights to Caleb Williams and build around Justin and build around the team. And DJ Moore said he wanted to be Justin, and Jalen Johnson said they wanted it to be Justin. And so like, they're definitely, I mean, Justin Fields had his name chanted at Soldier Field at his last game. Like he's an incredibly likable, gifted quarterback who's not given a great situation in his 3 years in Chicago. So there absolutely were a lot of people that wanted them to stay with Justin Fields. I thought this was pretty much a no-brainer from the minute they qualified for the number one pick.
Are there fans expressing concern over Caleb's sort of eccentric nature at all, or is that more of a made-up controversy?
I think it's an internet thing for the most part. You know, you get the occasional text of the show, the occasional tweet, but, you know, those right-wing charlatans are saying he's the erosion of masculinity and that sort of thing. But not many people that matter are putting their name on those opinions. And by all accounts, all of his teammates like him, and all of the research that the Bears have done has made it so that they're not even bringing in Jaden Daniels or Drake May or J.J. McCarthy for top 30 visits. So they're not concerned. I'm not concerned. Paint your nails. Do whatever the hell you want. Just throw for 4,500 yards and 35 touchdowns and win 12 games.
Yeah,
that's all I think anybody who's reasonable cares about.
Last thing, how is being friends with Nick Wright? Is he somebody that you're Have you ever won an argument or a debate with Nick?
I would say so.
Would he?
He would say no. But no, Nick's the man. Going to Kansas City this weekend for his vow renewal / wedding ceremony that him and his beautiful wife never gave themselves. I will be the best man in that wedding. Nick is an incredible human being. For as talented as he is, for as smart as he is, he's an even better dude. And I'm thrilled for the success of First Things First. He is on a hit TV show with ratings that are just growing and growing and growing. He is a star, and I would just say to people that they haven't seen anything yet, that guy is going to have a monster career, and he already does, but it's going to, whatever you think of, you know, Keith Olbermann, Bomani Jones, Scott Van Pelt, Bob Costas, like that's the level of intellect and talent that we're talking about here.
How was getting to do First Things First last month?
That was awesome. Yeah, that was crazy. Was in town for the Barrett Sports Media Conference, and the day before we were leaving, Nick texted Pony and me, Andrew Filipponi, and said, bring an extra suit. Broussard was on vacation, and I guess Greg Jennings and Eric Mangini, their New York-based football analysts, weren't available, and obviously the Bears are the story of the offseason, and then Russell Wilson in Pittsburgh, and then they trade Kenny Pickett like 10 minutes before we go on the air, so it was also topical. And so, yeah, got to do some national television.
Is that something like, were you nervous for that at all? Just
being yeah. Well, you know, still, I mean,
Still get nervous for things like that.
Yeah, good nerves though.
Yeah, of
course. Know what I mean. Like I think if you don't get, I don't get nerves going on the radio today at 2:00.
Right.
But you get a little bit of nerves when you're doing something different,
something
and big,
new, and
that sort of thing. Like, not enough that it was debilitating or anything, but yeah, sure. I was pacing around a little bit before we walked in, of course.
Yeah, well, you were great on First Things First, but more importantly, you were excellent today on the Awful Announcing Podcast. Thanks so much
I
for
agree.
Coming on.
That
I
is
really
more important.
Yeah.
I agree. Thank you, Brandon. Thank you, man. I appreciate you plugging the book, and really appreciate it, man.
Yeah, that is Danny Parkins. I'm Brandon Contis. This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Please rate and subscribe to this podcast. Please also subscribe to Awful Announcing's YouTube page. But regardless of how you consume Awful Announcing and the Awful Announcing Podcast, thanks for listening and be good.
Thanks for listening to the Awful Announcing Podcast. For the latest news spanning the sports media landscape and more, check out awfulannouncing.com and follow us at awfulannouncing.com.